episode 20 of the ReWrap Podcast, where we talk all things about the photo, video, and creative lifestyle. Opposite me is the viral filmmaker, cinematographer, dynamo that is the Jaren Schneider. And we got a special guest this week, Sacramento's own Tam Nguyen, systems engineer for Resource Magazine, and a photographer in his own right, and I am portrait and headshot photographer, Karaminder Guman. Guys, let's get this show on the road.
That was quite the intro, man. Such excitement.
Hey, man, that's what we're here. That's what we're here every week to do. I'm always excited about this show. I love this show.
Tam, it's good to have you with us this week.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So Tam is here for a very specific reason, but before we get to that, we're going to go through a couple of the things that happened the last week. And specifically, I guess we can start off with what happened today. GoPro,
as we record this.
Yeah, like they announced a new camera that basically is the first time they've ever deviated from their old design.
Yeah.
Now, do you guys understand the name? Why do you think it's called the Session?
I got an idea.
Okay.
Because literally you turn this on, it starts recording. There's no record button. You turn it on, light blinks, it's going like a session.
Well, I mean, the on button is the record button, so you still have to push the button.
Well, yeah, you got to turn it on. You turn it on, it records. There's no...
Is it true that the new GoPro doesn't have a detachable battery so that you can replace a battery on a shoot?
No.
Oh, you probably can't. Yeah, it makes sense. However, they did make the battery last a lot longer.
Yes.
Well, that's what they said with the last version. It kind of flopped.
Well, the guy from The Verge took it out whitewater rafting, and he said that it was the one that was still going at the end of the day. The other two GoPros he had long since died.
Yep.
So if anything, it's better than what we've got. I'm sure it's not stellar. I'm sure it's fine. It doesn't do 4K. It's basically like that the Hero 4 LCD, which
is
has
it?
Yeah.
Do they both do 1440p 30?
The specs. Let me get the specs out on it. Hold on.
But you know what else I noticed in the Verge video as well, which is nice, is that it does have a small little LCD on the back, not to show you what it's recording, but just to give you a status of like, all right, we've been recording for this long. But what I do believe I did see was here's how long the battery's going to last you. Because that was the biggest question I've ever had whenever I used a GoPro, which was just mystery of, well, could die now, could
die
10 minutes.
Any point.
Yep.
Yeah, it's
no idea.
Buried. It does 1080p 60, 720p 100, and 1440p 30.
Right, but the older, any other GoPro did 1440p 30 is what I'm saying.
It doesn't seem familiar to me.
But 1080p 60 is perfect. That's what I would choose for this.
Yeah, I wish it did 4K though. I mean, I just because, I don't know, I don't ever export in 4K, but I like having that extra room.
But I really like the shape of this. I really love the design of that. It's just a
cube.
They
totally took that.
Didn't you have a talk with Sigma last PDN Expo, and you were like, you know, I like the ability to have 4K. You can like zoom in your subject, and you have the look of two cameras, but you only have one in actuality.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
why
trick.
I like to do it.
That's
it
a good
is.
Trick.
I actually learned that from Lee Morris. He's the one who taught me how to do that back in the 1080 720p days.
Basically, ladies and gentlemen, what they're talking about is basically cropping in.
Yeah, you crop
in. That's literally what they're all saying. All these words were just saying, Lee taught me how to crop in on video.
Yeah, you crop.
That's it. But
anyway, back to the GoPro. It's waterproof to 33 feet with no separate housing required, which is really cool.
What?
And the mount works is it's different than the other like clip mounts, of course, because you know the GoPro is differently shaped now. But you can rotate the GoPro as a cube inside of it, depending on how you've got that thing attached to stuff. So you never have to have like an upside down video anymore. And it has built-in Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, all that sort of jazz. So the really only way you can do anything on this thing other than hit record is you have to use the app.
For the settings, at least to get the settings right.
If you want to, let's say if I wanted to change from 720p 100 to 1080p 60, I got to whip the app out.
And tell me how many times you would do that, Jaren. Please?
I mean, never.
Yeah, exactly. So you just set it up the one time you own the camera. But yeah. I feel like I can hand this camera to my mom and be like, look, mom,
just push
the button and boom, recording. That's it. Yeah. And I love that. But it also has a mic on the back, Jaren, as well as the front.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Dual mic system.
And it actually is smart enough to know what's happening to adjust. So it'll use the back one. If the front one is being like hit by wind, it'll use the front one. If the back one has issue, it's actually kind of cool. I think that maybe GoPro is doing is they're testing new tech like this in these smaller devices that will then be introduced in the later versions, kind of like how Canon does their cameras. Like, right. They didn't introduce the STM in the larger cameras yet because they're slowly rolling it out into from the Rebel to the 70D to the 7D Mark II or whatever.
STM means a step motor, which means that it as focusing is very quiet on a lens, so the noise doesn't go back into the camera. But nobody really uses GoPro audio anyway, and they just use that whatever that techno band is that they use that all their music for.
That sounds like the same band. Technology they use for an iPhone, where you have two microphones on the bottom, and it kind of does its own.
Three microphones, Tam. Three.
Is it three?
There's one in the front, one at the bottom, and one at the back.
Oh, I didn't know. I thought they only had two.
So if you use Filmic Pro, you can actually select which microphone you want to record. You can manually select the microphone you want to use your iPhone to record from.
Interesting.
But we're going to talk about cell phones later, guys. Yeah. Don't get into that now.
Yeah, we'll hold off. Anyway, so that's the GoPro Hero 4 Session. I will probably not buy one. But I know that I can understand where the market is. They're so much smaller. It's probably much easier to use. You can hold a bunch more of them, and the battery lasts longer. So if you're into shooting action video still, I think GoPro is still attempting to show that they're king. I don't think anyone's going to argue with them.
But can I say, Jaren, I really like this product, and I hope that this is the future of GoPro. Like, you know, the old design, fine. You let that go, but you develop this design and you've pushed through with this design and you continue with this design.
I think the other design only existed because it looked like a camera. There's no reason for it to look like an SLR.
No,
so.
No, but this is fantastic and it's smaller. Yeah. So bravo.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is we're going to go back to, was it episode 2 where we talked about Affinity Photo with Pratik? It was early on.
It was very early on. And I believe you're right.
So for anyone who doesn't know what Affinity Photo is, it's basically a Mac-only platform that is going to compete with Photoshop. And it went into beta in February of this year, and it blew up immediately. Like, it was all over Reddit immediately. Everyone was talking about it and trying it out, and then sort of the fanfare sort of died because, you know, it's a beta. It's done. You're done testing it. It's over. They're going to release the finished app later. I sat in and talked to the Affinity people because they have given me reason to believe that Affinity's final build is like weeks away at most. Like, we'll see this thing released publicly for a very, very enticing price point of $50. That's not a subscription. That's like straight up you own it for $50. And that's going to happen sometime in the next couple weeks. And so I asked them some questions about, well, what did you change about the beta that is going to be in the final release version? Because it's been a while. And they said that they have been making changes. And one of the coolest things that I heard is that they made changes specifically based on what Pratik said in his review. They listened to him, and they adjusted to it.
The review that we, on our podcast?
Yes, on our podcast.
Our podcast actually had, like, some change in the world?
Yes.
That's impressive. I don't know what to say now. I'm a bit scared of saying things now because I might influence somebody and change their lives forever.
So what they describe, so here's what they said. I talked to a woman named, her last name is Houston. And she's the project manager, and she told me that they got a bunch of feedback, but Pratik in particular was helpful.
Ace Master Retoucher.
So we've got some great input from photographers and enthusiasts, and Pratik was one of the highest profile reviewers we encountered that early on in the beta, and his review naturally highlighted areas that we knew we needed fixing. Still, he described the state of Affinity Photo very fairly. During the beta, we refocused some dev resources to do a much better job in the develop persona in particular, so images would look great when they are open and are adjusted there now. Pratik also encouraged the team with positive reinforcement that the app can suit pro workflows, and in his 4 out of 5 rating gave them a measure to improve on. So, I mean, they really did listen. So it'll be interesting to hear and see in the next couple weeks if this is going to take place. And they've told me that we'll get an early access to the Affinity beta. The Affinity platform will have it, not beta, full thing. And we're going to give it right back to Pratik. And he is waiting. He already knows he's getting it. And to see exactly what he's going to think of the finished version. And that's where I think we'll see him be his harshest, is because they no longer have the beta to hide behind. And as nice as Pratik is, like, he's a really nice guy. Whenever I've asked him to review anything, he's really brutally honest. If he doesn't like something, he will tell you about it. Like, I think I gave him something, I can't remember what platform I gave him a couple years ago, but he said, at no point in my life would I ever willingly use this ever again. After, you know, being relatively nice throughout most of it. So he's gonna say something. If he likes this platform, he gives it a 4 out of 5 again, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Because he has really high standards.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited. I really hope that this works out, because if they get the money they need to finish building this platform, we're going to see it on Windows machines too, which is going to be nice because there's a lot of retouchers who have moved on to Windows. I know that another guy that I work with, his name is Chris Lambeth. He's a PC guy, and Pratik is mainly PC. Tam on the phone is mainly PC. He's using his Mac right now begrudgingly. Tam, did you know anything about Affinity? Did you pay attention to the release at all?
No, well, I did hear about it, and I'm actually intrigued to know what they have cooked up in store. At the same time, I want to know if it works really well with Lightroom, because you know, like with Lightroom, you can either hit Control or Command E from mm-hmm. Lightroom, and it takes you right to Photoshop, and then you edit in Photoshop, and you hit save, and it updates that whole thing back in Lightroom.
Yeah,
I think to me that's really important. Like, that's really part of my workflow. If that works, I'm all for it.
Well, Lightroom does support editing in other external editors, and then you know it sends a file out. You save that file in that other app, and it'll refresh itself in the library when you're back to it. So
I can almost
guarantee
it's not going to be as seamless, but it should work.
It should work, right? Right.
Jaren,
do you know how big their crew is? Affinity Photo, like you said, you spoke to Houston.
Yeah.
10 people, 20 people, do we have it? 5 people?
Ashley Houston was her name. Let me see here. So we have 7. They have 7 experienced devs is what she said. And those are the ones specifically. So Affinity is actually part of a company called Serif. And Serif makes multiple programs like this. Like, they have an InDesign competitor too. So they have 7 specific devs.
Well, this is important, Jaren. They have clout. They actually have a history of shipping product, which is good. This is not going to be vaporware or crappy, like not going to be able to have the funds to support this if they don't sell enough units. This is important. This is good.
Do you have any contact information, or do you, I guess, personally know the product manager of that company? Because I feel like if you're a product manager for a company that makes software for creatives, you kind of need to know how to use Photoshop, and you need to know what your clients want and how to use the software to kind of be the lead on that.
So what I've kind of gathered from their team is that they started at their core very similarly to how Adobe started when they first became a company. And they are a foundation made up mainly of creative professionals themselves. They're photographers or graphic designers who are building something they know they want. So they aren't just building with the idea in mind of what photographers are looking for. They're actually trying to build it with what they want to do. And I think any problems we might have, which one of the main things that was confusing to Pratik was like how the color balance, color temperature was in the Affinity beta. And it was based on like, it was like percentages or points or something. It wasn't like in Kelvin. So it was real confusing to figure out where you were and how to get back and where to go. That I think might actually be more on where this team is based, which is in Europe, than it is based on like what we're used to doing. I don't know. Maybe that was just a really dumb decision, but that's the out I'm willing to give them just because of their location.
Interesting.
But yeah, they say they're fully a bunch of creative professionals who really want to build something. And Karaminder, earlier you said that this isn't going to be a flash in the pan. Well, the thing is, I asked them straight up, if Adobe came to buy you up, which is Adobe's reaction to most competitors,
right,
would you accept? And they say that they have a full vision for Affinity and for the whole Serif platform that isn't going to be done for another 10 years. And they don't, and their team doesn't feel like they're really just ready to give up. They kind of want to see their vision finished. So hopefully that means they're going to plan to stick around for a while.
So they don't have an exit plan for their product. They just want to keep going.
Yeah, their exit plan is to make a cool product.
That's really good to know, because I've seen a lot of companies whose goal is to just make a really quick buck by making a really cool product, and then they sell it to Google or Adobe, and they just kind of like ship it off, and then they just wash their hands. And this is really good news. I'm really intrigued.
Yeah, I hope this is true. Like, I'm really rooting for that to be true. But yeah, like I said, they're building an ecosystem of Affinity apps. They're going to release regular free updates, similarly to how Adobe and Photoshop are doing things. There won't be another major upgrade for 2 years, which means the $50 is going to last 2 years. That's I mean, based on what we're paying and we're used to paying for Adobe programs, if this thing works 90% as good, there would be almost no reason to feel like you're stuck in Adobe platforms anymore.
Well, I feel like, you know, the same can be said for people who use GIMP. I mean, you can get the same stuff done with GIMP as you do in Photoshop, but I mean, does it give you the same workflow? Does it give you the same, you know, ease of use? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I think people are stuck with Adobe not only because it's the proprietary platform, but it's because it's so easy to use, and it takes people time to relearn the entire new platform.
Yeah, that's true. Although Pratik did say that learning Affinity didn't take all that long. You just had to figure out where some of the buttons were, where their menus were based, and after that, like, all his shortcuts seemed like they were the same.
That's good.
Everything worked the same. A lot of another reason people stick with Adobe is like the tools are so powerful. You can't get that stuff in like GIMP. Some of the warping tools and like the are just really, really good in Photoshop, and the healing clone stamp and the healing brush are all really good. They appear to all be very good in Affinity as well. And they built their own custom RAW reader. So we're going to have a third competitor out there. So we're going to have Adobe Camera Raw, we're going to have Capture One, and we're going to have Affinity. And it'll be interesting to see which one of them actually is best at reading raw data.
Well, we have Apple Raw as well, but I don't think
Apple.
But I don't know. It works for Photos app or
the new app.
Yeah, but they do that. They have updates where they update their raw processes, but I don't think it's much of a difference. Yeah. So, but I do remember people preferring the Aperture look of raw processing to Lightroom. I remember that.
And I know that professionals are preferring Capture One's RAW reading to Adobe Camera Raw right now. So we'll see like where this lines up. Is it equal to? If it's equal to Adobe Camera Raw, then we're good. There's nothing to worry about. Like, that's already good.
I'm just excited that there's just another choice, another player, and it looks like a decent, good quality app coming.
Yeah, for sure.
That's a very good point.
I love competition.
I'm sorry, but that's a very good point. Every time you see competition, the consumers always, you know, end up benefiting from all of the products.
Ergo Sigma.
Yes.
As soon as they were rooting for them so hard, I think people really wanted them to succeed. I mean, now that they are, the world is a better place because of it.
I mean, I think you were the only one rooting for Sigma.
Okay, when I say we, I mean me, myself, and I, apparently.
Yeah, just generally. I mean,
well, I was rooting so hard for them, and they're succeeding. And it's
To be fair, Sigma does not make a lens that I can use unless it's. Wait, do they make Micro Four Thirds lenses?
They do.
Okay, then I guess I could start.
They really do.
We don't talk about those too much, do we?
Okay, you know, on a side note, this isn't on the docket, but I did learn that it is very soon that we're going to see Sony mount Sigmas coming. I think when I talked to the CEO a couple years ago, the market was not there. The market is there.
Yeah, so the Sony EF mount, I'm sure.
It's not EF, it's E.
E-mount.
E-mount. Well, we'll see some native E-mount Sigmas probably in the next year.
Well, I'm getting confused because E-mount was for their, it just denotes like their APS-C size sensors, and then I guess they have an FE-mount, which is their full-frame E-mount sensors.
I don't know.
So FE-mount.
Wait, what about Canon? What does Canon use? Isn't that
EF?
EF.
Oh, Jesus.
That's why I was confused. It's an FE and an EF.
And then what's Nikon?
F.
See?
Hey, Leica mount.
Yeah, whatever.
Which is what? Leica?
M mount.
M, yeah.
See. Oh, okay. That's different.
And Fuji's X.
Yeah, the X mount.
All right.
X mount. All right.
Speaking of Fuji, how's this for a segue?
Oh, this is a good segue.
Month number 2 of camera power rankings are in. And
we need like an intro, like camera power rankings. Month 2.
We can do that. Why don't you just do that every time? Okay, so we added 4 new voters this month. The 4 are Zach Sutton from Lens Rentals and F-Stoppers, Hansi Ho, SLR Lounge, Dave Kai Piper, who is a UK-based fashion photographer, and the one that I'm really excited about is Roger Sakala, who is the founder of Lens Rentals and pretty much the smartest and most like in-tune dude in the camera evaluation industry. Like, if you need to know anything about any camera or lens, Roger has it in like a Rolodex in his mind. He knows exactly what he's going to talk to you about. So other than that, the team of people was exactly the same as last month. And the rankings went like this. Number 10, Phase 1 XF. Number 9, Sony A7S. Number 8, D750. Number 7, Canon 5D Mark III. Number 6, Sony A7 II. 5, 5DSR. 4, Sony a7R II, that camera that is not out yet, but has a lot of people talking about it.
And that's a new entry to the list, Jared.
It is a new entry to the list. Number 3, the Pentax 645Z. Number 2 was last month's number 1, the Nikon D810. And in shocking fashion,
up 8 spots!
The Fuji XT1. Now,
respect to the Fuji. Respect.
This surprised the hell out of me.
It's a damn good camera. It was high on my rankings as well. What was it on yours, Jaren?
We don't reveal our. It was like 5.
Oh, sorry. Mine's in there.
The thing was, it didn't rank lower than 5 for any voter who put it on their list at all. It was only excluded from one or two people's lists in its entirety. So it didn't score many number one votes. I think it got one number one vote. But it accumulated so many middle of the roads to upper tier votes that it just shocked me when when the points were added up that it had more than others.
That's interesting.
I think the one that got the most number one votes, it was tied between the A7R II and the Pentax 645Z. Either you had the Pentax at number one on your list or you didn't vote for it at all, is basically how it went. But the Fuji was just on everyone's list. And that, I think, speaks volumes.
Especially as it's an average and not just a couple number ones.
Exactly.
And also
it has an APS-C sensor instead of a full-frame sensor.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is a very good point, Tam. Yes. We're going to come back to that point.
Yeah.
We are going to come back to that.
Yes, we are.
We're totally leading
the horse.
What
I found to be most interesting is that those that were dropped from the rankings this week are the Sony a7R and the Canon 6D. They both fell off entirely. In fact, the 6D lost almost all of its support. I think only a few people, such as myself, kept it on the list at all.
We're ruthless.
And the Leica Q almost made the list.
Oh, it, just brand new. Okay.
Up until the absolute last voter submitted their votes, it was tied with the Phase 1 XF. But then the Phase 1 pulled ahead by a 3-point margin.
That's okay. So
it was close. So the queue is up there. People do care about it. People did talk about it, and they did have it on their lists.
Every single camera on this list is full frame except for number one. Or they're like two medium formats, and that's it.
Two medium formats, full frames, and an APS-C.
And an APS-C leads the camera power rankings.
What does that mean to you, Tam? Like, I'm just being serious.
Yes, yeah, what do you think about that?
When an APS-C camera is preferred by professionals, if you look at this list, this is a very respectable list of people who know what they're talking about. How is it that an APS-C sensor-sized camera beat out two medium format cameras and the best Nikon camera on the market?
I think it also worth mentioning that the sensor size of the Fuji film is in APS-C, and it only supports up to 16 megapixel, whereas the rest of the lineup here we see 20 something megapixel and even like the 810, which is like 35 megapixels. So I mean, I don't think when you blow things up, the Fuji film is going to hold up.
But does it have to?
Yeah,
this
is the camera power rankings of what is. Jaren, what's the. What was my thing? It was when I was doing this list, it was like when I want to create a fantastic image, this is the list of cameras I would buy in exactly this order.
Right.
Fantastic image for yourself or for your clients?
Both.
Well, if you ask Zach Arias, he would argue both as well, because he's a big Fuji fan and he has used the Fuji on his commercial shoot.
Yeah, see, I think I was following him up until the point where he made that thing about negligible.
Censored.
Yeah, and then he's like,
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
He had the whiteboard up and the size of the film and stuff.
Yeah. And then he's like, you really want to get big? Use 4x5. You really want bigger than that? Use 8x10. Like
that video.
The entire video made every sense possible until literally the last 30 seconds. I'm like, everything you said, you have invalidated everything you just said just now.
What did he say?
He kept saying good things about the Fuji film, and it's really sounded like a really long infomercial instead of.
Oh, you're saying that because he supported the Fuji so heavily, and I think he is a Fuji sponsored shooter.
I know that his statement. I wouldn't say he's a Fuji sponsored shooter, but I know that Fuji has sent him out on paid assignments and documented it in video to use as I don't know, Fujifilm propaganda, if you will.
Fuji has put money in Zach Arias's pocket.
Yes,
that's
they have.
That's what Tam is focused on.
They absolutely have.
Before we get too heavily into this, because we are going to discuss this at length, I do want to make sure that we get this this other story in here.
Yes.
Because it also relates.
It
and
does.
Then we're going to bring everything we just talked about all together into one epic showdown. So,
yes. So here's a blog post written by Hugh Hancock. Hugh Hancock, have you guys heard of Machinima.com? Jaren, have you heard of that?
I mean, unfortunately, as a gamer, Machinima does not have a particularly good standing with gamers. They're not good to content creators, but continue.
Okay, well, this guy's the founder of it. So.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, he's the founder of Machinima.com. He's a filmmaker. I'm not sure where he's based, but he says he's made films like Lord of the Rings scale, but on a budget of the Blair Witch Project. So he's done projects like that. And so he wrote this piece, very, very long piece, called What's the Best Medium for a Storyteller in 2015 and Beyond? And there's actually quite a lot of insight in this. It's a very long piece, but I kind of focused on the films part of things because he dives into films, television and web series,
video games,
pros, virtual reality, and even comics, and then of course the future. But as far as films goes, very good point he made, which is basically saying that the cost of production to like actually make a indie feature film is in free fall, where you can just use a DSLR, and not only can you use these DSLRs, they have crazy ISOs, so you don't have to actually bring in lighting or generators. You can just actually get a shot really quick inside of a place that you actually ask permission to use, like
using Natty Light.
Yeah, Natty Light, well, aka Natural Light, in like a convenience store or something that you ask permission for. You don't even have to set up a dolly anymore. You can get the little this little $200 self-balanced scooter, which Casey Neistat's been pimping around in his vlogs of late.
I feel like I'm the only one who's not buying one of those, and I feel really sad about it.
I'd like to buy one.
Right?
But the point is that you could use a gimbal, right? So you don't have to have like this guy who – you can use a gimbal to get a lot of steady shots instead of some steady cam guy who's been pay a lot of money for and you get a smaller setup by using a gimbal, and you can just get very high quality shots without a lot of experience, because you need experience to use a Steadicam. This is just some of the examples. Like, okay, fine, you're running and gunning and you've got all this great gear, but what about audio? Well, even Rode, right? Jaren, you just tested the Rode wireless
mic
system.
Yeah, I'm in the final
system.
Stages of testing it, like comparing it with some other stuff that I've got. But yeah, I've used it on a pro shoot already and it's worked great.
Yeah, turn it on and it works. You don't have to worry about
nothing.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about like what frequency or anything. It just works, finds a clear frequency, just works.
Yeah.
And all this kit does not cost a lot of money.
What about that kit that, Jan, you wrote a post about it on one of the guys on Kickstarter? It's like
the microphone?
Yes.
The Mic Me.
Yeah. I think
stuff
you should.
Like that is cheap too.
Are you going to do a comparison with that versus the Rode?
I'm going to compare the audio to just about everything.
That's
good.
I would love to see that.
But that right there is an example. That thing's going to cost, what, like $200?
Yes.
And it's going to basically make most shotgun microphones obsolete in small situations. Like, you don't need one anymore. Now, Cameron's making a face at me because they're not going to be truly obsolete.
Yeah.
Run-and-gun situations where you need to have a microphone someplace where you can't necessarily set up a whole set with a
Agreed.
Boom or lavs or stuff. That sort of thing. That it would be good for.
Yes.
That's what I meant.
Yes. And because of the lower price, I would say more adoption by a lower budget indie crowd, and they'll be able to get their content up and out there. But okay, let me continue where I'm going.
Yeah, yeah.
So the whole point is that all the tech to capture stuff is really cheap, and you can actually do it very quickly now. And then, of course, you edit it. And then what about distribution? Well, YouTube, right? That's like really – distribution is even really easy. And I'm sure that in the future, people can put their movies onto iTunes as well and sell it just like indie artists can, maybe even Netflix in the future too.
Didn't he make a statement though that the distribution was like was where the main hurdle was now, not gear, which used to be the hurdle? The hurdle
this
used
is
to
correct,
be gear.
Yeah.
Now and it's flipped because the distribution hurdle, the marketing and all that stuff, that's where all the money is.
Yep.
That's where it all costs. And
yep.
getting yourself out there is so hard.
Wait until Casey Neistat is done with his new app, and I think it's gonna make a change.
Is that what he's gonna try and fix? I was just thinking.
Is that Beamy? You talking about Beamy?
He sort of made an announcement a couple of days ago. He said that if you're a filmmaker, you probably won't like it as much. But his point, or I guess his philosophy, is he wants to create something that help others create, and then so. I think he's going to make an app that would help everybody else publish and share their content and their videos and photos really, really quickly in a better way than what we have now.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm so excited for it. I mean, yeah. Okay, so at least to harp on at least what Jaren was just saying was there's a quote that he keeps hearing from filmmaking is that basically there's never been a better time to get your movie made and never been a worse time to get anyone to watch it, essentially.
Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah. But at least in the future, that's what we hope that, like Tam just mentioned, Casey's app, which will help fix that or at least help in somewhat alleviate it more and give a more better platform for kind of curation and finding things. Because, that's
the
idea.
Yeah, what's the tie-in here then, Karaman?
The tie-in is basically that all this gear, like citing even films like Tangerine, which won Sundance, right? Yeah. And was shot on an iPhone in like a weekend, using like basic accessory of like the Moondog anamorphic lens adapter for the iPhone, which I think cost like maybe $150 or $200, something like that.
It's cheap.
And
anything that's less than $30,000 in filmmaking is cheap.
Yep. And they color graded it and edited it and put it out there as like, here's how we captured a story to tell a story. Did it? I think they shot it in a weekend.
Yeah. You know, another movie that was recent, that was bigger box than that, I think.
What was that?
It was by the guy who just did Avengers. I'm just completely blanking.
Joss Whedon?
Yes. Joss Whedon did a Shakespeare movie that starred all of everyone's favorite actors all at his house, and he shot it all in a couple days when they were all out there together, and they decided to do it on a whim. So the ability to do that sort of, the takeaway, it doesn't matter what the movie is, the takeaway is that it's doable to do stuff like that now, which it was not doable to do before. And that made it into theaters. Like, that was like a big, big movie, so.
I just quickly Googled what I was trying to find that movie, but instead I found that part of the Avengers was actually shot on an iPhone, the original movie, the Avengers.
Okay, so, all right then. So that right there, segue time. So last week we did a segment where we were talking about an article written on F-stoppers where the title was, will never replace, cameras. Like, the cell phone camera will never replace what we are using now as professional cameras. And Karaminder and I spent a good 10 minutes talking about why, one, you should never make a never statement, except when you're saying it's never going to never. You should never say that because of what technology has shown us in the past and where we're going. How if you tell someone that it'll never be there, as the old guys who refused to move away from films, that digital will never replace film.
It doesn't.
Film is king.
It doesn't.
Film is king.
Digital does not replace film, though.
It has replaced film. Stop it right now.
It has,
replaced film. Yes, it has.
How about this? It's augmented it so much to the fact that we no longer purchase film on a daily basis
and
or weekly basis.
Nobody
or monthly basis.
Makes new film cameras. If film was not,
well, Jaren, Leica
does. Yes,
Leica still does. Sorry.
If film was not already second fiddle to digital in the grand scheme of what people use to create things, it would not be just digital stuff made by the top-tier camera manufacturers, excluding Leica, the ones who service most of the consumers in the world. They would still be producing a film camera if film was not
second
fiddle
to
digital.
I don't think...
You cannot argue it.
Canon and Nikon don't make any more film cameras.
Well, that's because I don't think how much beef you can, with the film camera. I mean, you don't need a sensor, so it doesn't... It doesn't need a sensor to be upgraded. It doesn't need, film.
But they were making new film cameras relatively.
You buy the film that's better than the last roll you shot with.
Film cameras also are holding their value quite well in the secondhand market as well. I should say that too.
All right, fine. Let's go with this one then. Why is Kodak now maybe at best one-fifth the size it was 20 years ago?
Not even one-fifth. I think they got sold. They got bankrupt and sold, and now they're just a brand for a Chinese company now, I believe.
They were never even good with their own camera back in the days.
But the thing was, they are still the biggest manufacturers of film.
And that was because they started the business. They started the whole thing. So their downfall is really, truly sad. At the same time, I feel like they didn't really innovate.
What I will say is this. Film is probably, arguably, right now, in most cases, except in light sensitivity, still better than digital. The dynamic range of film and the quality, quote-unquote, that you can see when you shoot a film image is still better than digital. But that doesn't matter, because whatever amount it is better, it is not better enough to make it so that we won't still use our digital cameras. So the argument that I had with Karaminder it wasn't even an argument.
Well, we agreed, actually.
Was that when you say cell phones will never replace, like, the sensor in a cell phone, that I'm looking directly at that camera, not the fact that it's a phone, just the camera in the phone. When you say that will never be to the point
never,
where
ever.
It's so good that it doesn't matter that it's not as good as the larger cameras, you're fooling yourself.
It won't. You are fooling yourself by saying that, because I feel like...
Explain where I'm wrong.
If you go to a Dart concert and you need to shoot whoever it is that's singing up on the stage, you can't bust out your phone, take a photo, and have it look like what you would do.
But hold on, Tam. We're saying the argument made is never, right? So you're talking about today. And I think you are correct. But what you're saying, your example you're citing today is correct. But what happens in a couple years? Remember... it's only been 7 years since the iPhone came out, and
I mean, I'm going with the arguments that we have here on Elstopper's article that was written by Alex Stokes. He said that, the guy is an engineer, and I'm an engineer myself, and I understand physics and all that stuff. And I'm not saying that nobody understands that, but at the same time, I feel like you can only pack so many megapixels into one sensor, and at the Right. And then the minute you crank so many pixels in one sensor, it gets heated and it gets hot, and it would then have a lot of noise, and it would leak the heat to the neighboring pixels.
That's probably why the Panasonic GH4 struggles past ISO 800, because the sensor is too small. But Tam, Image Vision, a company that's based in China, just announced that they're releasing a Micro Four Thirds camera that shoots in 4K. That has a 102,400 ISO performance.
And remember, Jaren, that's because it's a backside illuminated sensor. You know what else has a backside illuminated sensor?
Sony does, right?
Actually, this guy for a little while. The Apple iPhone has had a backside illuminated sensor for quite some time. And when they introduced, I think it was the 5S, they talked about how, Tam, you're right, where they didn't go for more megapixels. They actually kind of stayed with lower megapixels. They wanted a bigger kind of like a bucket for capturing light and it being backside illuminated.
Pixel density,
be better. But they were able to get better low light performance because of the backside illumination, whatever it's called.
You still, even with that right now, you still won't get 102,400 ISO. That's something that we thought was reserved for the full-framed things like the A7S.
But just because you can crank it up that high, I don't think it's usable.
It is, and here's why.
Just because you can doesn't mean you should. That's my point here.
Even if you got to 50,000, Tam.
It doesn't matter. Guys, let me finish here. Hold on. There is something they're doing here that is very – this is the argument I'm having here. Just because you're saying the physical limitations of the sensor itself is what's holding it back. You're blocking your mind into using only the sensor. They've built software that uses the sensor differently to where they don't have to try and do more. This is called motion compensated temporal filter technology.
I don't care what they
and
call
advanced 3D noise filter, which reactively removes noise while it's shooting. So the noise that you normally would see is now gone.
Sounds like a bunch of I don't even know what to call it, but honestly, I don't see how you can put signal back to your entire image out of noise. You can't. What you're saying is what they're doing is they're literally pulling pixels. They're pulling signal out of thin air, and they're literally pulling out signal out of noise. And I don't think that's physically possible.
Well, you would think that until we look at what DxO did recently. where they've created a system that is able to take what appears to be a single image, but is doing more than that to fill in and creates a super raw. And that super raw is just as dense and just as dynamic range filled as something we expect out of a full frame DSLR. So when you're saying that we won't get these cool things, all these, the technology, the quality, that sort of thing in a small sensor, you're already wrong.
Do we have
already here?
Do we have any comparison on an image that is captured at a, say, a Dart concert that is taken by, say, a Canon 5D Mark III versus a DxO tiny little dinky physical camera that they just cooked
up? I would welcome DxO. That challenge. I would love to see that. We're not looking at today.
Yeah.
We're not looking at today.
We're looking at never, never.
Never.
Yeah.
And if you look at where the technology is now, and the thing is, when I see this 102,400 ISO on a Micro Four Thirds sensor, my jaw drops because that seems undoable. But it's becoming.
I believe it now.
It just seemed undoable. But to say that we will never get to the point where film is still better in many cases than digital, but digital became so much better that the, quote, good enough occurred, that we will become that point with smaller sensors where the good enough happens. And somewhat if I can go get a phase one and do a 50 megapixel with a dynamic at a 70,000 ISO with a dynamic range that's intense and crazy, I don't need it because I have a Fujifilm X-T1, and the Fujifilm X-T1 is good enough. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is, if it will ever replace is determined by what is socially acceptable as good enough. And that point will come, I guarantee it, in 10 to 15 years, we will no longer care about a full frame sensor.
I'm not sure about we no longer care about full frame sensor, because I think I'll still care about it. But I do also think that
I will not. I already don't.
You already don't. I actually pretty much between my iPhone and my Leica M, I'm fine for like quick pictures on the go. I'm using this like pictures of family. I use this just for sake of like snapshots, quick shots.
I mean,
I'm actually going to take the time and actually make and orchestrate a photo like I would as a professional photographer, that's when I'm whipping out my bigger camera when I'm slowing down.
And the thing is, though, I don't think that you're going to need that big. You have a Leica medium format, Tam, by the way. I don't know if you know that. He shoots with the Leica medium format camera.
Right.
I think you can
That's
get,
when I'm slowing down a lot. That's when I'm slowing down very,
I think
very
we're
slow.
Super close right now to the point where you don't actually need that camera anymore. And you could shoot with something that's like APS-C or smaller and get a photo that is just as beautiful.
Oh, I agree.
90% of use cases. And the
it's that last 10% that I actually bought that whole system
Thank
and camera
you.
For.
Right. But
Thank
that 10% is shrinking.
Oh, it is.
Paraminder.
I believe you. I think it is shrinking. And the next rumor is the next iPhone, not the 6S, but the one after the iPhone 7, will have two cameras that do what you were just talking about, Jen, I think earlier, where it'll do some sort of fancy...
It basically does internal HDR. It takes a lower end...
more than that. A depth of field, too.
Oh.
So like a stack focus type situation?
Yeah, I don't know how. I'm not really sure how it's doing it, but the understanding that I have is multiple cameras. And by multiple, I believe it's two right now they're talking about.
So that sounds just like one of the Canon cameras.
In
where,
a cell phone.
Where they made
In a cell
it.
Phone.
Yes, but it sounds like what Canon did a couple. I don't know how long ago it was ago, but Canon did make a camera where, within the sensor, there are two sensors stacked together, and you end up with
you're
a phase
about the
detection,
dual pixel, right?
Yes, you end up with a phase detection instead of contrast.
Yeah, that's in the new cinema camera. That's in the that was originally in a Rebel in the 70D, but they've made an even better version that's in the C300. It's like a double stacked sensor. Yeah.
Right, and then physically, I don't think you can stack so many pixels into one tiny little sensor. I mean, we're talking Moore's law here. I mean, Cameron, you know about Moore's law. You can only pack you can only double the amount of chips
every 18 months.
Right, every 18 months, and then that law no longer applies because we have.
It's no longer applied for a little while though.
Yeah, we have reached a point where we can no longer pack so much stuff into one tiny little physical device,
okay,
and that's why
what we're gonna.
But
do.
We're still doing it. I mean, like I just saw this. The Verge had a great little piece on where showing the advancements of Casio's technology in watches. They had one that was waterproof for tracking your water. Like when you're swimming in the water, they had one that did your heartbeat. They had one that controlled your television. And these are all separate watches. And now one watch, the Apple, all that in one watch.
Apple doesn't that thing you're wearing, you can't put it, you can submerge it in the water. So there's that. And also,
I just went swimming with it. I go swimming with it like every few days.
And it doesn't last for more than 24 hours. So you gain some, you lose some. You can't have it all.
Right. I do need to charge it every night. So there's that maybe disadvantage.
Right. Because
you
need the space for the battery. You can't.
Yes, you do.
So what are you saying then, Tam? What am I going to have to give up to get a 4K Micro Four Thirds camera that's the size of the palm of my hand with 102,400 ISO that works at that? Let's pretend it's flawless. It looks like the Sony A7S. What am I going to have to give up? And what do you think I'm going to have to give up for that?
Money.
Battery maybe? I'm willing to give
battery and money probably.
Space. I mean, you need physical space to have that big of a sensor.
But I don't. It's the size of the palm of my hand.
Well, right now we don't have it.
Well, I mean, they have actual samples. I've seen them. I mean, what they've got here is pretty lame because, you know, it's a Chinese company with no money. But I've, based on their examples, and I'm going to take them at their word until I've proven otherwise, that it works. So what we'll do is when this thing does come out, and I don't know how far away they are. It's called the Z. It might not be out until the CES next year. I bet that's what they're aiming for. Mm-hmm. When that happens, and we can look at exactly what this does, and you look at it and be like, okay, that is identical to what we're getting out of an A7S.
I would love to be wrong on this, honestly.
Oh,
and
man.
This sounds like, what was that Lytro camera a couple years ago? They were like, oh my God, we just cooked up this thing that you can like take a photo and you can focus later. You know, guess what? It flopped. I mean, I predict that.
Yeah, but
the technology
is still real. The technology is still real.
The technology was
exists.
Never real. They just made something. They made something that was already there, and they marketed the hell out of it.
Yeah, the light field sensor?
Yes.
Mm. To be clear, there were some rumors that the idea – how that thing worked is that it just took multiple shots at one time
right.
and stacked them.
That's not
That's
rocket
not
science.
Actually
Anybody
what that
with
does.
A brain could figure that out, I feel like.
Well, that one's not how that one works. I actually talked to a guy from Lytro who did not necessarily have the best things to say about Lytro, but one of the things that he did say – with pretty much conviction was that the sensor was special. There was something different about it. It didn't just take stack. Now, the ones that did take stacks are like the Sony cell phone that did that, or the LG. I can't remember which one it was. That's how that one worked. But the real light field sensor, the one that's in the Lytro Illume, which also flopped, you're right, that is different. That is special. So whatever they did. Anyway, it's beside the point. What we need to look at then is you're saying that you agree with the original sentiment that we will never reach it. And what I just said is by February of next year, you said you'd like to be proven wrong.
Yes.
That would be less than 6 months. That's not a very long never, Tam.
Well, we'll come back to this podcast in 6 months.
I'm okay
and
with
we'll
being
figure
wrong
it out.
For the next 20 years if I'm right in the 21st year. But if I'm already right by February of next year, what does that say?
I mean,
yeah,
honest,
Tam, hey,
I
listen.
Mean, I mean,
there's
honestly, the iPhone 6S is going to come out in, what, 3 months from now? And maybe,
yeah, September.
Right? Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll know what Apple packed into that tiny little sensor. Maybe they'll have a little dual sensor situation like Canon did a couple years ago.
I would think iPhone 7 is my
and honestly,
best guess
I would
for that.
Love to see the XO's sample images from a dark concert, and I want to see that alongside with one that is taken by the Nikon D810 and maybe a Canon.
But Tam, you're being so specific, like you want something now, and me and Jared are admitting now probably not, like unless there was like optimal lighting conditions for the phone to work in or for a cell phone camera to work in, it's probably not gonna get you what you want.
You can't
but we do believe in the future. We do believe in, like, you know, in a year, maybe 2 years, maybe even 3 years, that yes, it will be good enough. Maybe even 4 years. Who knows?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not,
that's what we're saying.
Funny enough, because Olympus said that pixel counts don't matter anymore. They said that 10 years ago. They were like, we believe in low.
They were ahead of their time.
Right. And guess what? They're still at 60 megapixel. And I mean, people use Olympus for fun. Who shoots Olympus for real? No, nobody. Because you can't pack that many megapixels into one little sensor.
Yeah, I listed the Olympus EM1 in my power rankings. I did, because I think that is a very...
You were not the only one.
I think it's a very professional, good camera. If I had to make images with a very small, compact kit, still images, I would choose that. I wouldn't choose it for video, but I would choose it for still images.
What I might agree with Tam with, though, is we were talking about overall, can we shoot with one instead of the other? But Tam, I think, is also saying that there's no way we're going to get megapixels out of these. I might actually agree that it might be difficult to get megapixels out of small
sensors.
Well,
that's why we have medium format. Right.
Yeah,
that's why we have
medium format for that. And the other argument can be said is, like, when would you need to blow something up really past 12 to 16, maybe 20 megapixel? Like, people say, well, what about a billboard? No, billboards
are low,
really
res,
low res.
Super,
like,
low,
no,
res.
Never. So there are very few circumstances where any human's going to actually need to blow anything up.
I would think the only time,
web now.
I think the only time we may need this, Jaren, and I see this coming on the horizon, is the I think it was a 10K TV somebody was looking at, and they said it was like looking out of a window. It was ridiculous. And so when it comes to using, to showing,
that's still like, that's only that. What is that?
10K. Let's say 10,000.
So it's 10,000 on one side, and that's still
no. It's 10,000. It'll be 10K. Like 4K is that way. So.
Four. Yeah. So that's only, what is that? Does that, that's
how many megapixels is that?
Let's four. See. I think it's four. Yeah, so 10 would be 10. So we're still not. It doesn't matter. We're still well within what we can produce on an iPhone sensor. Size.
I think so. No, you still need 10,000 on one side. I don't think iPhone
whatever.
Goes up to 10,000.
We
but
can
yeah.
do it. We
well,
can
you can do it.
Do it.
And
it's
also keep in mind that the more megapixels you pack into one sensor, the more processing power you're going to need to process all
right.
of that.
But processing power gets better.
Oh,
it
hasn't
better
got,
over time.
It hasn't gotten better for the past 3 years. If you look at your MacBook, your Intel chips, they have been hovering at about 3.2 gigahertz for the past 5 to 6 years.
But what they have done is reduce power consumption.
Right. But they can't make it faster because you cannot pack as many chips in one tiny little thing.
But what you can do is go dual core.
So
quad
actually,
core.
Right.
Octo core.
Right. So you double the physical size so you can have it faster, right?
That's what
Leica did with their second generation
right.
S medium
so my
camera.
Point
medium
is
format
you
camera.
Can't beat physics. I mean, eventually you're gonna grow bigger than your sensor size, and you can't. I mean, that's the way.
They can probably
make
faster processors. The only reason they haven't is because that people have been mainly concerned about battery life. But as battery life gets better, which it is getting better slowly, granted, slowly. But
we're gonna get a test of Gigafactory soon.
And then and when you talk about battery, you also talk about physical size. You want a big ass battery or you want a little battery, but you can't have both
with current tech. You're right, but like lithium ion was not well known for a while, and that's what became the standard after nickel metal hydride.
Yep.
So like, we're getting to the point where there will be another source of power we'll use. I have a feeling. I mean, I have no idea what it's going to be.
It could be.
My understanding.
I've seen cell phone recharges that take urine and make that into power and charge your phone.
I mean,
seriously, Dad, it's going to be urine. But
I mean,
no,
you can charge a phone by literally using a lime. You hook up a lime and a little penny, and then you hook it up.
Who's to say that, you know, your next camera you buy in the next 10 years won't be even solar powered? That solar power technology will get so efficient at being able to harness power from the sun that it actually uses it in conjunction with the battery.
I mean, watches already do that.
Yeah.
Watches already do that super well. Like
calculators.
Not your watch, but
my watch.
Citizen watches and Seiko watches. Citizen basically has perfected their solar power. So
I mean, that technology does exist, but I mean, a lot of when it comes to computer technology, people are talking about quantum computers now, because quantum, we're talking about really, really low level of computing power here. And that's the only way people can pack that much of computing power into a tiny little sensor. I don't think we are going to get there when it comes to camera sensor size.
Okay. Well, let's end on that
because
clearly we're not going to change his mind.
Nope.
But we'll come back as soon as I feel like he's wrong. We'll invite him back because there's really the only
we
way
we feel like he's wrong
right now. So right now, Tam can basically claim he's correct because right now there
and we agree with that. Me and Jaren agree that right now Tam is correct.
You cannot do
our keyword is right now.
Right now. So
right now,
until that changes, Tam is right, and I think he's okay with that.
I feel like I'm the opposite of whatever more stated about his law is eventually you're gonna get, you know, in every you're gonna double the amount of chips in your CPU every 18 months. I'm saying we're gonna hit a stop, and the stop is already here.
Oh wow! Okay. Well,
I think this is it. Like, people can try to make their sensors as cool looking, and again,
well, Jaren, it's nice knowing you. Might as well give up on life now.
This Fuji film has what, 50,000 ISO. Yeah, just because you can. I don't think you should. No one's going to shoot at
that. No, you shouldn't
on
the Fuji. You absolutely shouldn't on the Fuji, but we'll see.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Last story, and we're going to end on some good advice, okay? Because Sebastio Salgado's advice for young photographers today, Leo Johnson interviewed the 71-year-old photographer at an exhibition he had called Africa. And basically he said that, if you were a young student, probably around 21 years old, what would Sebastio recommend a young photographer to start his career today? What should he do? And so his advice was, I'm going to quote him here, quote, "If you're young and have the time, go and study. Study anthropology, sociology, economy, geopolitics. Study so that you're actually able to understand what you're photographing, what you can photograph, and what you should photograph," end quote. And so the idea is, most people just say, go out there and shoot. Just, study other photographers, practice. But what he's saying is, your photography is kind of like, it's almost like writing. Like it's a medium, but to be an interesting writer, I've always believed you have to have an interesting life. Right? We've talked about this before.
This sounds like something that Chase Chavez and also Zach Ayres have said in the past. They always said if photography is something you really love to do day in, day out, you should really start learning about other things, like running a business or learning about sociology and all the other stuff to compensate and to balance out your photography passion.
I wouldn't say compensate is the right word. I would just, but you are right, Tam. Like, I'm with you on that whole.
I guess.
Compliment.
Compliment. I feel like
you, being a writer or even a lyricist, if you do hip hop, or let's say here, a photographer, like knowing what you're photographing, why you're photographing it, what the purpose of what you're doing it for is much more supreme than just like being technically capable of being able to make a good picture and being there at the right time at the right moment. Your story behind the photograph is going to be much more powerful than just the photograph by itself anyway, because it's always going to provide context.
That sounds like something Casey Neistat would say.
Well, yeah, he's...
And he would be right.
He would be right, right?
I love that guy.
I know. Yes.
It's the only time when Tam is 16 years old and he loves watching vlogs on YouTube.
Every day, all day, every day.
All day. Well, the idea is that basically it's just to understand what you want to shoot. And understanding the possible impact your work that you do create could have in the world. And I think that's very important. What do you think? What do you say, Jaren? You guys talk.
I'm in total agreement. I have nothing to add to this.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it sounds...
How about this? You guys, both of you, because, I think you both lead very interesting lives. But so, Thomas, tell us, share with the audience how you decide to lead interesting lives and not just... Tam, you're reading a book about system engineers all day, or system engineering all day, and Jaren, you're not reading the manual to your new DJI Ronin M, but that how do you become just more interesting people that make more better interesting work?
You can go first, Tam.
I mean, it's funny because you said I don't obviously read book about system engineering. I just finished a book called Organized Mind, and I finished it last month, and I just finished another one. It's about how to deal with people and how people think, and I feel like the more I understand how people think and how they function, the more I can help other people. The more I can connect with people, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah, that does actually.
Because I feel
me,
like
it's. No, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm trying to figure it out. I'm trying to remember what the title of the book that I just finished. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow. And it talks about how people, generally speaking, they have two systems of thinking. This author, he calls it System 1 and System 2. System 1 is what makes judgment calls, and System 2 is the one that slows down and double checks the whatever System 1 thinks, and it's like the more you think about it, it makes sense. For example, it talks about how it hurts you more losing $20 than it makes you happy winning $20.
Hmm.
So like the little things like that, and then it always little things like that shape up the way companies do marketing. Like for example, you go to a store, and then they say like, you know, if also about voting, he said that people tend to opt in if that is a default option, than opting out. Like for example, the rate of organ donors in other countries are a lot higher because you have to opt out to not be an organ donor, whereas in the States you have to opt in, and because over there is a default option, people don't really bother doing it anyway. And then literally little things like that, it shape up our world, and then I feel like it's really fascinating. And then to me, it's never about how a piece of hardware works. To me, it's always about how people think and how they go about their life. And it's just really
buy black market kidneys.
Yeah, that too.
That was actually really insightful, Tim. I actually had never heard you describe the way you think the way like that. That's good.
Totally worth having you on the show, by the way.
Thank you, sir.
Great. Yeah. Jeez.
Jaren, mate, can you enlighten us, please, as well as how you keep an interesting life?
I try and interact with at least two people every day, and they don't have to be the same people, or they can be the same people. But the way that I didn't go study how to make a beautiful film. I didn't go study how to make things like that. I watched what other people were doing in various situations, and I thought to myself, well, what can I do with that style with what I'm shooting? So like, I like to watch documentaries, and by documentaries, I mean things as simple as like Anthony Bourdain on CNN. That's technically a documentary, and I watch how they shot that, and I watch how they tell that story. And actually, some of the best storytelling was Anthony Bourdain, No Reservations, in its final season. And the first season of CNN's Anthony Bourdain series was also really good. But the way they played with color and shape and the way that the camera moved with what they were shooting really created an experience. And it's difficult to actually, unless you're tuned to it, watch those things for the point of watching how they're making you feel. It's very, very easy to just get immediately sucked into what you're seeing and being stuck in the experience and not putting any attention into why you've been sucked into that experience. So I make it like an effort. I will watch the same episode, and it drives my fiance crazy, but I'll watch the same episodes of Anthony Bourdain 10, 12, 15 times, because it's only then that I'm actually able to detach from the story, because I've heard it so often, and watch what they're shooting and how they're shooting. And that's how I continue to get better at what I do, and I still think I'm terrible at what I do. So,
Jaren, you're not so bad. Come on. Compared
to what those guys are doing there, I am just crap on the bottom of a shoe. Those people are really, really great, and I really like watching them. And watching them improve over the course of multiple seasons is also a fun experience. If you watch season one and then watch season like whatever the last one was, you can actually visually see where they have learned and how they have adapted to traveling so much and on their schedule and what they've done. It's really cool to go on that journey with them.
I feel exactly how you describe Anthony Bourdain's No Reservations is how I feel about Top Gear. If you've ever watched the show, and how they make little films and little pieces. But sadly, a week ago Sunday was Top Gear's last episode as we know it in its current incarnation. So I'll pour one out for them, for those three lads. But to keep myself kind of more interesting as a person, I actually read a lot more. Like Tam, I read a lot of books. Like Jaren, I watch a lot of media like Top Gear to see how they tell stories, because I believe in, you know, whatever I do take a picture of, why am I taking that photo? What's the point of that photo? What's the significance? And I try and understand, like, I do a lot of work with nonprofits. So I'm involved with the reason why they're doing these things, the decision-making process. And then I actually make better photos because of that, because then I know, well, this photo is what this means and it tells this aspect of the story. And it helps round out my storytelling as well, that I understand what's happening around me, not just what looks good around me. And with that, episode 20 is in the bag.
I think that's a good way to end it.
Yep. Thank you for joining us, guys. Comments and questions, you can reach us at Twitter at Rewrap Podcast, and also at resourcemagonline.com. And you can email us at rewrap@resourcemagonline.com. Tam, what's your Twitter address so people can send you love mail and hate mail.
What about my Instagram? I'm on Instagram. Would that help?
Oh, okay. Is it at Tam is
Hungry? His. Tam is Hungry.
Yeah, Tam underscore is underscore hungry.
This is good. Tam, T-A-M.
Yes, sir.
For those of you.
Now, I'll ask Jaron to post up the links to the other books I've been reading. It's actually really good. If you have time,
Send me those. They'll be in the show notes.
We would love those. Yeah. Yes. And if you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and subscribe. Send us all some Twitter love. We'd love that. And tell your friends to give us a listen. Tam, you can tell your friends to listen to you on the show.
Once this is going to go live, I'm going to post the link to everybody. Take a look.
We all appreciate it. That is at Jaron Schneider on Twitter. I'm at Karaminer on Twitter. And this has been the ReWrap Podcast, episode 20. See you all here next week. Ta-ta. Bye-bye now.